With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today here on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the deadline is coming up for the Strengthening Organic Enforcement Rule Compliance. We'll have an update. And we look at some of the numbers in USDA's new ag trade forecast. But our top story today, continuing our coverage of this week's House Ag Committee hearing. 19 House members from different committees testified Wednesday before the House Agriculture Committee in a member day hearing that allowed lawmakers to promote some of their agricultural and nutrition priorities for the next farm bill. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican from Iowa, pointed to the costs for pork producers because of California's Proposition 12 and a similar Massachusetts law. She said Prop 12 has the potential to disrupt the free movement of goods around the country, and she called for the inclusion of her bill, the Ending Agricultural Trade Suppression, or EATS Act, in the next farm bill.
The EATS Act preserves California's right to regulate its agricultural practices within its own borders, while also protecting Iowa's farmers' access to interstate commerce. So I think that any radical activists pushing an agenda like this that have never stepped foot on their family farms should come visit a farm in Iowa. I've extended an open invitation to them. We'd love to show you how our farmers care and manage their farms and the environment in the process. So I look forward to continuing to work with the committee to build consensus around a durable and bipartisan solution to protect our family farmers from damaging and arbitrary mandates like Prop 12.
At the close of the hearing, House Ag Committee Chair Glenn G.T. Thompson said he appreciated the input from his colleagues.
Obviously, the goals for this farm bill have remained the same as what they were when I started out as ranking member 2 years and 11 months ago, and that is that we do this farm bill that is bipartisan, bicameral, and highly effective. And the highly effective part is incredibly important. I think the roadmap or the recipe for highly effective is very clear. We've been on that trail for now almost 3 years, and that is listening to voices outside the Beltway of Washington. And that's what you heard today, as we had members of Congress who came here to be the voice for before their constituents and to bring their views forward. Add that to the public portal, where we've had more than 3,000 contributions and ideas that have entered in this process. 171 members that have weighed in on the portal, over 1,500. The amount of information is a little overwhelming, but we've got a great team that has been working hard at that and doing a great job. More than 80 listening sessions around the country, somewhere around 37 states plus one territory, 80 altogether. And the public hearings that we've had here, like the one we've had today with our members, all important to our eventual successful and timely reauthorization of the Farm Bill. So we're going to stay on that path to success when it comes to America's number one industry, and all those hardworking families to provide us food, fiber, building materials, energy resources, rural economic development, connectivity, all the great things that quite frankly, this Farm Bill will support.
This was the last hearing scheduled for the year. We go now to Brian German with this week's Chill Hour Report.
In this week's California Chill Hour Report, brought to you by Dormex. Wake up your buds with Dormex. Starting off with another campaign this year, growers are reminded about the importance of chill hours and chill accumulation. Depending on how the winter months go will determine how well trees wake up from dormancy, which will have a significant influence on bud break. And while at the Almond Conference this week, we had the opportunity to speak with the Director of Sales for Alskim, John Mayer, who shared some insight on some of the tools available to growers that can help with spring emergence.
Well, first of all, Brian, thank you for the opportunity to speak to your audience on the Chill Report. Alskim, we're the manufacturer of Dormex, and we're proud to sponsor the Chill Report again this year. A few exciting updates we have on Dormex that we'd like to announce. First of all, in mid-January, we received CDPR approval for Dormex applications on walnuts. You know, we help continue to support Catherine Jarvis Sheehan and her walnut research up at UC Davis. She has some great results to share, and I hope she can share them with you in the near future. We also continued our multi-year trials on pistachios, and again, we have phenomenal results. We increased yields again in our trials, even in an on year. The whole key is timing. when to apply the application. Our label says 30 days before anticipated bud break. That's stated on the label. But more importantly, you want to watch your chill portions. You want to maximize your natural chill as much as possible. Ideally, you want to spray at chill portions of 65 or greater. And really, it comes down to how does that relate calendar-wise? As a rule of thumb, we're looking at between Valentine's Day and maybe the first week of March. That's ideal timing to maximize your yields on pistachios. And lastly, we're very proud to introduce a new product into the marketplace. It's called SeedFX. SeedFX is our 4-chlorfenuron. It's a water-based formulation, and it's labeled on a number of crops here in California. But since we're at the almond conference, let me talk a little bit about what SeedFX does on almonds. It stimulates cell division and cell elongation. In the tree, it mimics cytokinins, but it's much more substantial than cytokinins. It increases the number of cells and the cell wall thickness. This helps reduce the amount of June drop-off that you get. So basically what SeedFX does, it increases nut set and nut retention. Therefore, it increases yields. Timing of the application is from 100% petal fall until the nutlets are between 4 and 6 millimeters. So SeedFX, it's a great tool in your toolbox, as is Dormex. So the whole key takeaway is pay attention to your chill portions in your particular orchard, and you'll see great results with both products.
And throughout the dormant season, we'll be providing updates on how chill accumulation is going throughout the state. In reviewing information from the UC Davis Chill Calculator, as of December 5th, the Durham-Simmons Station has logged 18.2 portions under the dynamic model, with 317 hours below 45 degrees. The station in Manteca has registered 15.9 portions with 263 hours. There have been 400 hours in Merced with 14.5 cumulative portions. In Five Points, there have been 293 chill hours, equating to 12.9 portions. Finally, the Simmons Station in Shafter has registered 12.7 portions with 275 hours. And this has been the California Chill Hour Report, brought to you by Dormex. Tune in next week for another episode.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Will Jordan, when we return. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. The Department of Agriculture Wednesday announced updates to the federal crop insurance program. The updates affirm the use of USDA conservation practices as good farming practices for crop insurance. Recently, USDA's Risk Management Agency updated the Good Farming Practices Handbook as part of the agency's broader efforts to support conservation and climate-smart activities, as well as to improve crop insurance for agricultural producers. RMA Administrator Marsha Bunger says this update affirms producers can have peace of mind that using conservation practices will not impact their crop insurance. The updated handbook recognizes all conservation practices offered by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service as good farming practices for crop insurance. Farm Service Agency direct loan customers now have the ability to apply for financing and check their loans online. Rod Bain has more.
A new way for existing and new USDA Farm Service Agency direct loan borrowers to have easier access to loan applications and connected financial tools, as they can now
submit that loan application online.
Deputy Agriculture Secretary Sochel Torres-Small says additional offerings through the FSA online loan application include
some additional interactive guided support, as well as use their electronic signature option to submit that loan application online. And they can do that from their computer, from a tablet, or from their cell phone.
Access for individual farmers is available at
farmers.gov/loan-assistance-tool.
With work ongoing to make the online loan app available to married couples filing jointly on tax returns or legal entity available starting next year. The latest in USDA efforts to streamline the FSA loan application process. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Rod. Now we head to Will Jordan with today's livestock report.
In today's livestock news, the U.S. Meat Export Federation is working with local butcher shops in Colombia to enhance sales of U.S. red meat. USMEF's John Harris shares more.
With support from USDA, the National Pork Board, and the Beef Checkoff Program, the U.S. Meat Export Federation helps Colombian butcher shops more effectively merchandise U.S. red meat. Latin American Representative Homero Recio has more details.
Butcher shops in Colombia make up a larger part of sales in other markets in Latin America. The modern supermarket format is growing in Colombia, but yet so much of the product is sold in these butcher shops. There's still some expansion left in that model for MEF to work in. We are well received. We are welcome to work in that area. And we have really seen the ability for our products, pork and beef, to take market share because of the individual cuts that we offer, the quality that we offer, the size and consistency that we offer. They say, well, what's the price? That's obviously one of the major questions. But we try to move them beyond what's the price. And we have a person that does an evaluation of their business and comes back with recommendations. This has resulted in some cost savings for these butcher shops, additional point of sale material, redesign of some of the butcher shops, and providing information that those butchers can provide to their consumers.
The program focuses on beef and pork cuts that are underutilized in the domestic market.
One of the principal products that goes to Colombia on the beef side is the culotte, the cap of the sirloin. It's a very traditional cut in Colombia, but the U.S. product is of a different quality level. But what we've been adding over the last couple of years is some secondary cuts, like beef short ribs, beef tri-tip. On the pork side, the emphasis is primarily loins. The sirloin end of the loin is a very popular cut, as well as increasingly the bone-in full loin going into the marketplace. But the one real star, that's the pork brisket bone, which comes off the production of a St. Louis rib. That product is being sold fresh, but more and more is being cured and smoked, a value-add item in the retail marketplace.
For more, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
In other livestock news, USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Services influx of funds for programs in 2023 provides a great opportunity for producers to implement or expand conservation practices on their operations. I recently visited with NRCS Chief Terry Cosby to learn more.
23 was a great year, and we're expecting a lot more excitement in 24 because of all of the new things that are happening at NRCS. You know, one of the things I've heard loud and clear is that we need to streamline these programs. They need to be a little more transparent, a little more flexible. And so we're looking at that, how we do that. You know, the Biden administration passed the Inflation Reduction Act, and that brought another $20 billion to NRCS overnight. And it's a lot of excitement building around that. But when we have those kind of funds, we got to look at how these programs are working. Do they work for the producer? How do we make sure that happens? And we have 52 organizational units across this country. It's very important to be engaged.
For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
The compliance date for the Strengthening Organic Enforcement Rule is just a few months away. CEO and owner of Fruit World, Bianca Caprillion, said there are several things to keep in mind with the compliance deadline on the horizon.
And so I think some of the things that as growers we need to think about are talking to our customers and making sure that our customers and their customers are certified organic if they're handling any organic product. And it's not going to fall on us as growers if those customers aren't certified and we send them certified organic product, but they will need to be certified to be able to sell that product as certified organic product. And we, I think best practice now is to just get ahead of it and really encourage our customers, distribution centers, and anyone handling organic product to really look at the rule and get certified.
Syngenta Group and CNH Industrial have announced the integration of Syngenta's digital CropWise platform with CNH brands including Case IH and New Holland Agriculture. The collaboration aims to simplify decision-making for farmers and advisors while enhancing data connectivity. The integration facilitates seamless flow of agronomic data between machinery and digital tools, benefiting over 40,000 users in more than 25 countries. CropWise, also integrated with John Deere and AgLeader, plans further integration with FarmMobile in the U.S. The partnership addresses the high demand from farmers who are both Syngenta and CNH customers. The enhanced data flow supports more effective productivity and aids compliance with regulatory standards. The move aligns with the increasing adoption of digital farming tools and the push for more precise and environmentally friendly practices. The latest agricultural trade forecast from the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows a bit of a decrease from earlier expectations. USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer shared some of the key numbers in USDA's fiscal year 2024 trade forecast.
For fiscal year 24, exports are at $169.5 billion. Now, that is a downward revision of about $2.5 billion from August, mostly on lower grain and animal product values. Imports, we got higher by $500,000 than previously forecast, and mostly an increase on beef, vegetable oil, and grain products. And those imports now stand at an even $200 billion. And exports of $169.5 billion. So there is a trade deficit in there.
One of the critical components of optimizing ag tech advancements might require more collaboration. While speaking on a recent panel related to AI in agriculture, founder of Better Food Ventures, Rob Trice, noted that one of the big questions is still data standardization.
There's a couple different ways you can look at this. For instance, in the Midwest, you got the John Deere Op Center that works well on a tractor with over 150 horsepower. Won't do much out here, especially though, when you have all the smarts and the implements in the back. If we actually think about it, there are organizations that are working on this stuff, like a group called Ag Gateway, another one called the Purdue Open Ag Technology System Center. There's a startup called Leaf. So there's work being done, but more has to happen. The other point is we have a lot of academics that have worked to standardize terms and so forth. And a lot of those folks, they've done good research to just sitting, collecting dust on a shelf, and it needs to get out into the market more.
The California Rice Commission will be hosting grower meetings next month in Williams and Yuba City. The meetings will provide rice growers and handlers with the latest information on key issues impacting the industry. The morning meeting will take place at Granzella's Banquet Hall in Williams beginning at 8:30, and the afternoon meeting is scheduled to begin at 1 at the Hillcrest Plaza Room in Yuba City. CRC personnel will be going over the industry's footprint and will also talk about a referendum and key CRC programs. David Guy from the Northern California Water Association will be providing a water outlook in 2023 and beyond, and CEO of USA Rice, Peter Bachman, will be going over 2024 initiatives. There will also be an overview on the next farm bill and what's happening in Washington, D.C., as well as what's next for the state of California. More information about the rice grower meetings is available at calricenews.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
How did the tradition of the Christmas tree get started? We have one of several possible theories coming up on This Land of Ours.
No one knows for sure exactly how the tradition of decorating an evergreen tree for the holidays got started, but one story is called
The Blessing of the Fir Tree.
Agriculture Department history researcher Anne Effland says this goes back to the early 700s in Germany, where pagan druid tribes who believed trees had spirits would decorate oak trees.
And when St. Boniface was converting those tribes, he felled an oak tree to prove that it didn't have a spirit in it. And in the process, it knocked over all of the trees in its path except for a small fir tree which survived. And the legend is that he blessed that fir tree as a special symbol of God's blessing because it survived the fall of the oak. And from then on, then this Christmas tree has been associated with Christian spirituality.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Are you stressing out this holiday season? The holidays can be stressful, but there are some ways to reduce that stress level. Gary Crawford talks with an expert on this edition of Agriculture USA.
Happy holidays!
Ah, yes, it's the holidays, a time of peace on earth. But for many people, it's more like stress time.
Yes, this is an extremely stressful time.
So coming up on this super stressful edition of Agriculture USA, how to recognize and handle some of the stresses of the holidays. I'm Gary Crawford. So are you feeling a little bit stressed right now? Well, maybe that's not always bad.
The stress that we experience on a day-to-day basis oftentimes can be healthy. It drives us to succeed. It drives us to learn. It drives us to do a lot of positive things.
Or can drive you crazy. Kansas State University Extension behavioral expert Brad Dirks says a stress here and a stress there, it might be okay. But he says stress is additive. So let's demonstrate that concept with some nice holiday-type music. But let's throw in another layer of holiday cheer. Feeling the stress a little bit? And of course, more.
Down the chimney, jingle bell rock. Looking for your
Yep, it's in your sock.
Starting to feel the stress a little bit. And, of course, more. Now, Brad says you could handle one thing.
But if two things or three things are layered on top of each other, there's an additive experience of stress that makes it difficult to handle.
And he says at some point, sometimes,
the scale tips and the stressors become overwhelming to the point it affects us and impairs our ability to be successful in our lives.
Or to enjoy the good things of the holidays. And in many cases,
we get overwhelmed, we get tired, we get worn out, and we've done it for how many years? And now again, with everything else adding to that stress level,
it can be really rough because many of us are trying to come up with money for gifts, and there are special meals and gatherings to plan for and relatives to visit and gifts to wrap and a million other things. What's driving all this? Brad Dirks says, for one thing,
we're driven by expectations, and there's external expectations of the family. We've always done this in the family, and therefore it's your job now to maintain this, and there's expectations we place on ourselves. Is this how I think it should be? I should be able to do this and accomplish this.
And so he says it might be good for us to take a look at all of the things around the holidays that we do almost without thinking and ask the question,
if I'm not enjoying this, or if I'm so tired at the end of the day that I don't enjoy the family when they get here, is this worth it?
And to be clear about this,
it's not that we're doing negative things. It's just that even if it's good, if it's overwhelming in its scope, we need to just look at this and go, how do we change this? And then be intentional about making some changes.
Doing so, though, in conversation with family and or friends, asking the questions,
do we have to do what we've always done? Or how can we go about making this enjoyable for everyone and reduce our own stress?
Of course, having that conversation might stress me out, but it's a great idea. Meanwhile, Brad says we can physically be affected by holiday stress with all kinds of symptoms, and we might not even realize it until we stop and take an inventory.
What is your experience of this stress? Is it in your shoulders? Is it in your back? Are you getting headaches? Are you tired? Are you depressed?
Are you having insomnia? Brad said there are things that we can do to alleviate some of those problems. Eating the right types and quantities of food, of course, exercising a little bit, not depending on pills or alcohol to relax. And one more thing.
We used to call it biofeedback, and now we call it mindfulness.
Mindfulness. It's just a little routine that Brad Dirks says really can work for you. First, find a quiet place to do this, or use noise-deadening headphones, and
drop your shoulders, take three or four cleansing breaths, focus on something that's positive. Some people think of go to their happy place, whatever you want to call it. If we relax our shoulders, do some deep breathing exercises, close our eyes, focus on our breathing for 3 to 5 minutes, learn to discipline your mind, those times of mindfulness can be very effective in reducing that in the here and now stress.
Of which there can be a lot during the holidays. So he says, every night, if you can,
spend 10 minutes relaxing your body, deep breathing. And those things are very, very effective. I mean, it sounds kind of weird.
Sounds touchy-feely.
It does. It does sound touchy-feely, but it kind of resets your computer back to kind of closer to baseline.
And it can really help make the holidays much more enjoyable. This has been Enjoyable, I Hope, Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Eligible organizations now have until February 2nd to apply for funding from the first round of USDA's new Regional Agricultural Promotion Program. Rod Bain reports.
The notice is official. Funding applications are now being accepted for USDA's new Regional Agricultural Promotion Program.
We are announcing specifically the first $300 million of that tranche to be allocated. And the conditions that we've placed on the first $300 million is that they can be invested anywhere but in the top four agricultural markets.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack made that announcement as part of the recent meeting of the White House Export Council, which the secretary serves as a member. The $300 billion tranche is part of a total $1.2 billion five-year funding availability from the Commodity Credit Corporation.
To expand opportunities to diversify our reach. The sad reality for American agriculture is that we've put too much emphasis on a handful of markets in terms of agricultural exports. Roughly, our top four or five markets basically are responsible for nearly 60% of our exports. And so we believe it's important and necessary for us to figure out ways in which we can expand the number of market opportunities and increase our commitment to those that are not in the top four or five.
Eligible applicants of RAP funding include nonprofit U.S. ag trade organizations and state regional trade groups, U.S. agricultural cooperatives, and state agencies involved in approved farm and food export market development activities.
About $1.1 billion is going to be utilized to expand assistance to our cooperators to be able to go out in these new market opportunities and to invest and to provide promotions and presence to encourage American agriculture opportunities there.
Special emphasis on this first tranche of funding will be ag export market establishment, expansion, and promotion in the regions of Africa, Latin America and the Caribbean, and Southeast Asia. Likewise, those markets not eligible for focused RAP projects include China, Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. The Secretary does explain one exception to the list of top export markets ineligible for RAP-funded efforts.
We did not exclude Japan just simply because we saw a significant decline in market share in Japan, so we want to make sure that we are stepping up our game in a place where we think there's opportunity.
Applications are due by February 2nd, with additional information on RAP funding available at grants.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's Brian German with today's interview.
Jennifer Hagee, I am a dairy advisor with University of California Cooperative Extension in the northern San Joaquin Valley.
And we're talking today about some information that you'd presented at a recent field day looking at feed rations. And let's kind of start with the survey of what you were looking at. It a lot of nutritionists involved and information gathering there. So let's just kind of start with how that process worked and we can get into some of the results there.
Sure. So the project I presented was a survey of California dairy nutritionists on their byproduct usage in California rations. The thinking behind that is we know that water availability is, you know, potentially going to become a bigger issue moving forward. And so if we if the dairy industry does not have the water that they need to produce forage, which of course the forage is going to bring in that necessary fiber to maintain rumen function, gut health, and just general productivity of dairy cows, if we're not going to get that, you know, that fiber from forages, we potentially need to look at byproducts to be a partial replacement for that. And on the converse side, I think it was summer of 22, we had issues with rail deliveries coming into the state. So concentrates weren't coming in. So also looking potentially at, especially in that case, those California derived byproducts to potentially be a replacement for some of those concentrates that might be missing in the ration.
So kind of a dual purpose there, just looking at what some of those other options are. And with this nutritionist that you got some responses from, I remember it seemed like it covered quite a bit of number of cows.
Yeah. So with our response rate, those responses from those California dairy nutritionists, we have data on byproduct feeding for about 930,000 lactating cows in the state. So that's a pretty good portion of the California dairy herd. Not surprising, most of the cows represented in our data set are in the San Joaquin Valley. So, you know, just over 87% of the cows, of those 930,000 cows, are here in the San Joaquin Valley.
And of some of those results and some of the byproducts, what seem to be maybe the most popular, or it may be gaining some traction, maybe losing a little traction there? What were some of the results in that?
Sure. So I think, you know, not surprising, almond hulls and whole cottonseed were the two most frequently reported Fed byproducts in the state. Obviously, almond hulls make sense. We grow most of the almonds in the world. So we do have a lot of almond hulls to feed. One thing I thought was interesting, and I've done, you know, some feeding surveys over the years, but for the first time, almond hulls and shells made the top 10 list. So almond hulls and shells, that's basically just a definition. If it doesn't meet the quality of an almond hull, it's designated as hull and shell. And so that's the designation is if it's more than 15% crude fiber, it has to be sold at that lesser definition. So I just thought that was interesting. You know, almond hulls were number one, but then almond hulls and shell, you know, came in at number six. So both very, very high.
And with those, there was also some information as to, you know, what percentage is included with these byproducts in feed rations. And it's looking just maybe a little bit under half there.
Sure. Yeah. So we saw, you know, we saw a huge range. So we still have dairies in the state that aren't feeding byproducts. And so that range went from zero up to 80%. So we did have some nutritionists reporting that in their highest fed herds, 80% of the ration is coming from byproducts, which obviously is just a tremendously high number. When I took the responses and weighted those nutritionists, when I asked them for their average inclusion rate and I weighted it by the number of cows that they feed in the state, we came up with that weighted average of byproduct inclusion rates of 41%. So 41% of the lactating cow ration on average in California is actually coming from those byproducts.
And you'd noted some of the maybe logistical challenges and water challenges there, but what were some of the other reasons given for this inclusion of some of these byproducts there?
Sure. So every nutritionist who answered the survey did say that they're feeding byproducts because of the value that they bring to the ration. So that, you know, they're actually, they're worth the price. They're bringing something valuable to the ration, and they're not just that they're cheap. And price and you know, because they are cheap, was selected by only 38% of nutritionists who answered the survey, which I think speaks a lot, you know, to this mindset of, you know, a lot of work goes into formulating rations. And so for a feedstuff to be incorporated, it really does have to bring value. And we're not just feeding things because, you know, because the price is right. And then another popular option was availability. So 65% of nutritionists reported that, you know, they feed byproducts because they are available, which makes sense, again, if we're thinking about potential forage or concentrate shortages, either long-term or short-term.
So while it's a bonus or a benefit that things are available and affordable, they are providing that value. Otherwise, they would sort of be a non-starter there.
Yes, I think that's a safe assumption to make from the data that we collected.
And lastly here, it was just kind of noted as maybe a summarized take on this of it seems like the trend has been moving upwards. And is that the expectation for this to continue to be maybe more prevalent or continued use maybe increasing here in the years ahead?
Sure. I think for the last 5 years, most nutritionists reported that they did have increased feeding of byproducts. And then, you know, when we asked them to look out into the next 5 years, that same 80% of nutritionists reported that their byproduct usage will likely increase in the future. So I think that's probably a trend that we'll see come true. Just again, because of all the uncertainty of feedstuffs in the state. And, you know, pivoting a little bit, I mean, I think this work really speaks to, you know, the sustainability and resiliency of the California dairy industry, especially of that feeding program. And so sticking on that same theme of sustainability, we currently are working on a project looking at sustainability metrics of the dairy industry. So that's going to be a couple prong approach. The first will be a survey to actually look at folks' water and energy usage so that we can benchmark it and show improvements from the past and kind of where we need to go in the future, as well as looking at nitrogen balances and moving that nitrogen around further off of the farm. So that's, I think that's the next big thing, at least in my program, that's happening. And so I'm hopeful that we'll have some good data to report out on that.
Thank you, Brian. This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Shannon Douglas, a diversified farmer in Glynn County, has been elected to a 2-year term as president of the California Farm Bureau. Douglas previously served 3 terms as vice president and is the first woman to head the organization. The California Farm Bureau was founded in 1919. Douglas succeeds Jamie Johansson, who served 3 terms as president, beginning in 2017. She was elected Tuesday at the Farm Bureau's 105th annual meeting in Reno. Douglas is an owner of Douglas Ranch in Orland, which raises cattle and grows walnuts, as well as corn and forage crops. She also co-founded Cal Ag Jobs, which is an online listing of employment opportunities in California agriculture. Douglas has served as director of the Glynn County Farm Bureau and as chair of the California Farm Bureau's Young Farmers and Ranchers State Committee. She is a graduate of the Leadership Farm Bureau Program and the California Agricultural Leadership Program and participated in the American Farm Bureau Federation Partners in Advocacy Leadership Program. Here's something to get you ready for the holiday weekend. A holiday time story unfolded recently as what is dubbed the People's Tree was lit in the nation's capital. Rod Bain has the details.
Now on display through the holiday season, the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree in Washington, D.C.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Sounds from the lighting ceremony that took place in late November. Among those joining Speaker of the House Mike Johnson turning on the lights, West Virginia 4th grade student Ethan Reese.
My grandma's a retired history teacher, and she told us that over 100 years ago, most of West Virginia looked like virgin timbers. I learned that most of our forests were clear cut long ago, but there were many people who helped restore our forests. One of those people was my great-great-grandfather, who became supervisor of the Monongahela National Forest in 1931.
That was part of Ethan's winning essay in the U.S. Capitol Christmas Tree Essay Contest. That not only allowed Ethan to help light the Capitol Christmas tree, but earlier that same day,
he was asked to express how he felt about his state, why he loved his state, and why he thought it was important to acknowledge the public lands within his state. And to do this in the concept and in the context of the endless, wild, and wonderful Christmas tree theme for the 2023 U.S. Capitol Christmas tree.
Joint Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in lighting the USDA holiday tree. Also from the Mountaineer State, providing some history about the 2023 U.S. Capitol Christmas tree, U.S. Forest Service Chief Randy Moore, who, like Ethan, attended both tree lighting ceremonies.
They've stepped up to provide us this beautiful 63-foot Norway spruce that grew in the wild and wonderful West Virginia mountains.
The they referred to by the chief is the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia. That national forest has a previous history of providing the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree.
In 1970, when this tradition started, it was the Monongahela that provided the first people's tree. It was a 40-foot Norwood spruce. 6 years later, the Monongahela provided a 41-foot red spruce.
Christmas ornaments made by West Virginia school children and members of the Shawnee Indian Nation adorned the Capitol Christmas tree. Director of the Capitol Grounds, Jim Kaufman, notes the Shawnee also provide the nickname for the 2023 tree.
The tree is nicknamed Waltham Tekwi, which means bright tree in the Shawnee language. The name certainly rings true.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That is today's agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media, at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.